Welcome to the Alcohol Addiction Podcast. My name is Lee Davey. I'm not an alcoholic. I refuse to be anonymous. I am someone that doesn't drink alcohol, and I spend every waking moment of my life helping other people do the same. Today, my podcast guest is Liv Bury. She's a bit of a polymath, really. She's a professional poker player. She's a TV presenter. She's a writer. She's a very good guitarist, if you like heavy metal music. And when she first came into poker, the media christened her the Iron Maiden, which is nothing like what Liv is, but that's the name that they call her because of her interest in heavy metal music. She's also an effective altruist, and she is the co-founder of Raising for Effective Giving, which is a non-profit which raises money and charity, raising money for effective charities to reduce pain and suffering in the world. And interviewing Liv is always a very nice moment for me, a very nostalgic moment, because Liv was the first person I ever physically interviewed after I decided that I was going to leave the railway and become someone who writes about poker. I just remember thinking to myself one day, "Well, Lee, you never knew how to write anything, and now you're writing about poker. How about you interview some of these people?" And I remember Liv was in Cardiff filming Late Night Poker, and I found her email address somewhere. I think it was on her webpage. And I reached out to her and said, "Could I interview you?" And she said, "Yeah." So I went over to the Celtic Manor, and I interviewed her. I remember having a photograph with her because I was a bit of a fanboy back then, and an interviewing career was launched, I guess. So thank you for that, Liv. Really appreciate you being my test dummy at the time. And I bumped into Liv at the Bahamas during the PokerStars Players No Limit Hold'em Championship. And I interviewed her for CalvinAir.com, a company that I do freelance work for, writing about poker. So when you listen to this, the conversation starts out about poker. We start talking about the PokerStars Players No Limit Hold'em Championship. But it very, very quickly moves into life in general. Liv wrote a brilliant article for Vox magazine called "How an 18th Century Priest Gave Us a Tool to Make Better Decisions." And we focus our interview on that. And we cover things such as positive and probabilistic thinking. We talk about loneliness, because loneliness in a poker world is a very real thing. And of course, loneliness when we decide to become somebody who doesn't drink alcohol, or while we're drinking alcohol, is a real thing as well. And we also talk about friendship, because as you know, when we become someone that doesn't drink alcohol, we sometimes lose our old friends and we need to find new friends. And as Liv is a bit of a master networker, actually, I ask for her opinions on that. I hope you enjoy the interview. I certainly enjoyed having it. It's a really good, deep conversation. Liv is a very, very rational and logical thinker. So some of the things that we talk about during the taster and the intensive, particularly the work about Joe Dispenza, it's not really the way that Liv thinks about life. So it's interesting to have a second view on that, or a contrasting view. So listen, enjoy. If you've got any questions whatsoever for Liv or myself, then you can email me at thetruthaboutalcohol@gmail.com and I'll get them answered for you. Thanks for listening. Welcome to CalvinAir.com. I am here at the Palmers with Liv Bury. Liv, I've already asked you, how is it going? You've got to get used to it, I guess.
Of course. No, so yeah, I busted the PSBC, the 25K, on day one, very end of day one, which is definitely disappointing. Mm. You know, I usually run deep in those kind of tournaments. Expected at least a cash, you know, but that's how it goes. Well, on average, around 60, 70% of the time. So it is what it is.
I knew you'd know the statistics. I'm going to talk to you about your recent Vox article, "How an 18th Century Priest Gave Us the Tools to Make Better Decisions." Mm-hmm. I thought it was brilliant, actually.
Thank you.
I was actually reading it thinking, what a bitch. Like, she's so good at everything. Sticking in front of a camera and she's on the TED. I know she's writing and she's really good. She's a great poker player and everything else, you know. So, yeah, I thought it was fantastic.
Thank you.
And it reminded me when I was reading it, when I was on the plane, and you could feel the vibe in Atlanta about this tournament. Mm-hmm. I get on the plane, it's fantastic. I get to the airport and he's buzzing. I get into a limo and the kids in there with me are buzzing. And then I get to the desk and there's two grinders next to me moaning and groaning about the Supernova Elite thing. And I'm thinking to myself, what are you doing
here?
What are you doing here?
What's your problem?
Right, yeah. And then I read your article, and I was thinking about it. These hardwired beliefs that people have and how you can change them. And I think PokerStars have done an excellent job. Let's start there. This tournament, you've got to be an absolute cynic or have a real problem with a lack of Bayesian theory. To, you know, like, something's going on if you...
You just have to have a... I mean, for you to find the negative out of this tournament, you have to have basically your identity attached to the notion of, oh, I you know, you basically have to come in with a very fixed mindset that you want to hate on PokerStars because, like, I mean, this is just an objectively good thing for poker. How can you not? They've added not only 1 million to first, but they've added $330,000 platinum passes, people that would never have played otherwise. So that's an additional 9 million. So it's 10 million added to a poker tournament that we then all get to play in.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, if you're finding a way to now gripe and moan about that while still coming and playing it, that's one thing. If you want to find a way to gripe and moan, but then and for whatever reason not come, that's fine. But to come down and then still gripe and moan about the fact you're playing in a $10 million prize pool, added to the prize pool tournament, which has given a bunch of people the chance to literally live their poker dream as well that would never have gotten the chance. Fuck off.
Mm.
It really frustrates me when people can't see the wood for the trees.
And they don't need to be here because there
are. No one's forcing you to be here. That's
there are a few poker players that aren't here, even though the whole world.
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, if someone really like deeply believes in you know for they want to boycott the tournament for whatever ethical reasons they've decided and they stick to that, then that's absolutely I respect that. But to come and find a reason to gripe. But that said, I haven't really seen many people griping, or I haven't seen anyone griping, but I believe that you've seen that.
Well, I saw it pre-tournament.
Okay.
So I think reading your article,
right?
What you said in your article is there needs to be, whenever we have an assumption that something is a hard rock, kind of like, yeah, this is a belief and I'm not going to change it, mm-hmm. then it's the availability and the prevalence of the evidence and how strong that evidence is to change your mind. So with
right.
people like these grinders who are like kind of like got it fixed in their head that PokerStars screwed them over and are terrible people who don't believe in customer service, this is evidence that all we care about is changing the lives
right.
of
Right, I mean,
customer.
The question you have to ask yourself is, you know, what is the evidence I need to see in order to change your mind? And if you say there is no evidence that I could ever be seen, that I could never be shown to change my mind, then you are fundamentally being irrational because there has to be something. If for example they said we're going to provide a tournament that is infinite added value, literally infinite money, this is obviously an extreme hypothetical case, but let's say they do that. If that still doesn't change your mind, you know, we're going to add infinite money and infinite opportunity to everyone in the world, and in fact, all future humans that could ever live, and so on. You know, and you still come away and say, no, this is bad customer service; they're not giving enough. Well, I mean, extreme example, but that's an example where like, your Bayesian reasoning is breaking down. So then the question is like, well, how much is enough? And like, if some people genuinely go, well, you know, this is still not enough, and they have good quantified reasons of why that's the case. Well, now that's at least they've thought through it. But I think with a lot of people, the issue that you're taking, and I would agree with, is that people don't. They've sort of come in with a preconceived mindset that they want to find reasons to hate on someone or something.
Hmm.
And we don't, you know, I, to move it away from talking about just particularly this tournament,
yeah.
whatever. In general, like when we see people, you know, like the political divide that we're seeing in the U.S. or in many other parts of the world as well, where I mean, I'm someone who is very much, I'm not a fan of Trump, right? But that doesn't mean that there aren't some things out of, like, let's say he does 1,000 things while he's in his presidency. There will be some things in there which are probably objectively good for the world.
Yeah.
And if you can't take your blinkers off for a minute and go, okay, I'm going to look for the things that are, at least find the silver lining. There are some things that are done right, which actually, had I been in his spot, I would do the same. Or, in fact, I wouldn't have even thought of, and actually that's an even better idea. There's going to be a few things in there that are good. Doesn't mean that he's then makes him objectively a good person. Doesn't mean you then side with him. And
yeah.
it's like this is like having a minimum level of nuance that I think we all need to have when we approach how we think about the world. And And that was what I was trying to get across in this article, basically, is that there's a lot of things that are very complicated and complex, and if we come in with an extremely predetermined mindset, then we're not going to be able to see the nuance, and we're not going to be able to make our beliefs accurately mirror reality.
Hmm. What you just said then reminded me of, I listen to Sam Harris a lot. From listening to Sam Harris, I got to know about Jordan Peterson.
Mm-hmm.
I started listening to him a lot. A lot of it went over my head. A few things stuck. Got his book. First chapter I thought was great. Stand Up Straight with Shoulders Back. I thought that was really good. I introduced it into my old alcohol program. Mm-hmm. And then he lost me a bit, right? And I was talking to someone about it, and he was like, oh, Jordan Peterson, no, no, you can't be listening to him. And suddenly it clicked that peer pressure could prevent you from changing your beliefs as well.
Oh, yeah.
And in that moment, I was like, hang on a minute. We can't just discard Jordan Peterson. I like one chapter, and I maybe didn't like the other 19,
right.
But I could take that away.
Absolutely. Exactly. You can usually extract value. There's usually some, you know, the reason why, particularly the issue of Brexit, right, is a very polarized thing. But it's not, the fact that it is, the reason why it's a politically sensitive topic is because it's not clear cut. You know, there are very strong reasons for us to stay in the EU, and there's also actually very strong reasons for us to leave the EU. The question is, which, you know, if we had a perfect prediction machine that could perfectly evaluate all the consequences and all the minutiae of all the different complicated economic, socio-political systems, if we had that perfect system, we might be able to come to that. But the point is, we don't.
Mm.
And it's not a clear-cut issue. And again, I think on net, like, I don't know. I don't have a strong opinion about Jordan Peterson because I haven't read that much of his stuff.
Mm.
I've heard a lot of the dumb things he said, but I've seen some really smart things he said. So it's, you know, our minds are, you know, life is easier if we can clearly put everything into black and white in these, you know, these simple boxes of good, bad, or good, averagely bad, and, you know, averagely good and clearly good, or something like that, you know. But the world is not that simple. Everything is sort of this discrete, this is a continuum.
Mm.
There aren't these discrete boxes. And so our sort of, the way we can, I guess, improve the way that we build accurate beliefs is to try and make, you know, our minds can't unfortunately work on this perfect continuum where we sort of move freely about as and when we need to. We do have to put things in boxes, but the more boxes you have, the more closely you act, you know, you mirror this continuous spectrum
mm.
of things. And if you just have two boxes, good and bad, that's clearly wrong. So yeah, it's tricky though.
I was thinking about black and white thinking when I was reading your article, actually. Whenever I upset my wife, it's always because I'm using black and white thinking.
Mm.
So how do you get into that spectrum? How do you get into thinking in shades of grey? I mean, and how have you been able to do that throughout your life?
Well, I certainly haven't always been able to do it throughout my life, and I still struggle with it. Like, don't by any means think that I don't.
Mm.
But generally speaking, the more emotionally attached we are to something, even if it's a positive emotion, not just negative emotions, then the harder it is to think in grayscale, and the easier it is to think in black and white, because emotions are not correlated to nuance. And so I think just with age and maturity makes things easier, obviously. I'm definitely a less emotional person than I was when I was 18.
Mm.
But surrounding yourself with people who you feel are emotionally mature, and that gives you sort of a higher sort of benchmark to aim towards. Like, I've sort of been fortunate that I've sort of surrounded myself with the rationalist community, who are, it's not that they're unemotional, but they're people who have a really good sort of understanding of their own emotions, at least the ones who are doing it well.
Mm.
And then also trying to think in terms of probabilities in general, which is where I think poker players, we have that edge where we naturally think in probabilities when we're thinking in the game. Well, that's because we know that we're uncertain. It's not clear cut to us, oh, they definitely have a full house, or they definitely don't. No, we know it's like, we can never be certain, and so we will assign probabilities. I'm 80% confident, you know, that person has a full house, whatever. And so we then carry that into our everyday lives. And so if you see, you know, everything that you, every decision you make, every prediction that you're trying to think about the future, or even thinking about something that's sometimes in the past, I mean, it either did or it didn't happen, but the point is that your knowledge is imperfect. And so looking back at your imperfect knowledge, you can only go, okay, well, I'm confident to say 70% that, as a ballpark figure, that, you know, this person did go to this event at that time that they told me, but there's still a 30% chance they're lying or something like that.
Yeah.
So it's about, with all things, like, just remembering that it's all on a somewhere on that spectrum between 0 and 100. And taking these like ballpark estimates. And another thing that I found helpful is just making formal predictions about the future.
Right.
Like, I haven't done them yet for this year, but I did it last year, where I wrote down like a list of things, of sort of statements, some of which were to do with my own personal life. Like, one of mine was actually, I will have a TED Talk.
Right.
I will have a TED Talk which will get this number of views. What's my estimate? I think my prediction at like 30% likelihood or something like that. Or I will win this much money in poker tournaments, and I put that at like 70%. You know, the likelihood I think it would come true. And then also things to do with world events, like political things, sporting events, you name it. And then the goal is not to get, you know, everything that you write down for all 100% to come true. You want, say if you do a bunch which you have like a sort of 70% confidence level in, you want 70% of those 70% to come true, 20% of the 20% and so on. And so you can get, and that's how you can sort of test your accuracy. And you do that enough and you will become better calibrated. And so again, that's a way of sort of training yourself to think in this like grayscale way.
When you're doing that and you're getting those goals almost out of your mind and writing them down, I will be in a TED Talk that has XYZ. Mm-hmm. Just read a book called Breaking the Habit of Being Yourself by Joe Dispenza, and he talks about there being an infinite number of possible futures in the quantum realm. And if we focus on those futures and force our thinking and feeling to bring it into the present, then it will happen, type of thing. Where do you think about that kind of stuff from a rational perspective in terms of visualization?
Right.
And
I don't subscribe to the idea that, again, that I think that's black and white thinking. When people say, oh, you know, because everything is possible, you just need to think, if you wish for it hard enough, it'll happen. That's, again, oversimplification. I don't think things are that black and white,
right,
and simple, because, I mean, you could then take that argument to its logical extreme of like, well, I really, really want the entire universe to just be images of myself. I don't know, just something ridiculous, or like be made of purple streamers. So if I just really want it hard enough, then that will happen. Like,
because that's no different than saying I want a Ferrari by the end of 2019.
Exactly. So I think that, yeah, I mean, I don't think by saying, oh, well, this is guaranteed to happen, that it, you know, that's clearly stupid, because some things are literally physically impossible, mm-hmm, by the laws of physics. But if nothing else, they're just so statistically implausible that you're sort of setting yourself up for disappointment. But that said, there is definitely value in positive thinking. And the sort of it is like a dichotomy, because there are some arguments that if you know, this positive thinking behavior is more likely to be successful if you sort of blinker yourself into believing it blindly.
Yes.
So it's like this, it's like you have to almost like give up your statistical humility and this probabilistic thinking to like fully commit to something and just say, this is my only option, this is my only option. To, you know, make is that then a self-fulfilling prophecy?
Yeah.
And I don't have an answer to that. Like, that's why I, you know, when people say, well, like, you're just poo-pooing visualization, like, that might work. Yeah, maybe it will. What I care about is that people don't sacrifice their happiness, or they don't sacrifice their cognitive abilities on some like whimsical things that which actually don't really have any evidential proof that they're likely to happen.
Yeah,
you know, to
like,
work.
It's, I guess, like the law of attraction. Like, don't just sit in your bedroom visualizing a Ferrari and think the Ferrari's going to
that's going to materialize. No,
yeah.
Like, as with all these things, like, usually, the most likely hypothesis of all of this is just that if you visualize something enough, it means that you are making it enough of your focus and your goal that you're going to be extra motivated to work extra hard for it.
Oh,
and if
you
work extra hard for something, then you're more statistically likely to achieve it.
How about this hypothesis then? Because this is what I've been thinking, because I think you might say these are just statistical anomalies, but when I kind of really think about certain things, and then they happen in my life, right? Mm-hmm. I think, well, we can only like take in so much of what's around us at any one point in time, otherwise we go insane. Mm-hmm. But now I'm visualizing, I'm telling my subconscious, well, actually, I want to appear on a TED talk. So now anything that is relevant to getting me there, which I would normally not see, maybe a conversation with this person who just passed me, is now leading me there. So my visualization is telling my brain to start looking for this stuff, whereas I wouldn't looked at it before.
Right.
And then it happens, and you're like, holy shit, this works. I just can keep doing it all the time.
But it's like, there's a selection bias there, because you're only going to notice the things that you've like focused on,
yes.
And you're going to ignore all the other things. And so it's going to feel more meaningful to you, even though actually you're just, your conscious experience is basically narrowed down to just remembering those things. It's like the classic, people over remembering all the bad beats they've had, but not remembering the times they've bad beat someone else.
Yes.
Because there's more of a, you know, if you come in with a mindset, I'm an unlucky person in poker, you'll remember all the times you've gotten unlucky and forget about the times you've gotten lucky. And vice versa, if you think you're a truly lucky person, you'll remember all the times you got lucky and discount the unlucky times. So does that mean that actually the probabilities stay the same? Most likely. Yes, as far as we can tell, statistics doesn't change in terms of our intentions. You know, the universe isn't, you know, sort of going to be following all of, because it couldn't, because if we've got all these different competing, you know, the one human wants one thing and another person wants another thing. Well, now it's like it can't satisfy everybody, right?
Mm-hmm.
So maybe randomness does just stay unaffected, but maybe it doesn't. We don't know. Clearly, I don't have a clear answer. It's a thing I think about regularly.
Yeah.
You know, when I won San Remo, I kind of had a premonition before I won it.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like I was really likely to win this tournament for some reason. And then I won it. So I'm like, holy shit, there's something to this. But then I've had other premonitions about other tournaments, and I didn't win them.
Yeah.
Not as strong, admittedly. And so sort of the pure statistician in me goes, well, I was likely to remember. I was likely to win one at some point, and that was one I won. And I'm more likely to remember the sort of the strong feeling, the positive feelings I had during it because I won it. But it feels like there's a little bit more than just that going
on. Yeah, I think there's a. I can't remember what the philosopher was or author was. It was like, it doesn't take any more effort to think positively.
Exactly. And so that's how I view positive thinking.
Hmm.
It's a free roll.
Go for it. It's a free roll. It's
a free roll, and that's. That's why I would never discourage anyone from doing it. I think it is a free roll. If it is that there is metaphysical stuff going on, there are supernatural things that can drive us because of the power of our thoughts, well, fuck, it would be a real shame to miss out on those because of, like, you know, being excessively skeptical. But at the same time, you need to keep enough skepticism to not just, like, fall into this, like, wooey, unscientific thinking where you're just like, no, man, whatever I dream up will happen, you know, and then you're just going to not achieve what you really could have if you put your mind to it and worked hard, for example.
I will end on, somebody said earlier on, there was two things you said. How are we for time? Have you got a...
I'm fine. Okay,
cool, that's good. When you get bored of me, just kick me.
Sure.
Two things you said earlier on that I thought were really important. One of them particularly around friends, right? So as I was reading the article, first thing I was thinking to myself was, wow, none of this means anything if I'm not self-aware. And I wasn't self-aware until I was 35. So let's start there. I wasn't self-aware until I was 35. So
define what you mean by self-aware.
I wasn't thinking about the decisions I was making in life at a greater depth. So I wasn't thinking about my values. I wasn't thinking about beliefs. If you would have asked me what my values were back then, I wouldn't know what my beliefs were. They weren't really anything I paid any interest to. I was just a carbon copy of my parents.
Right.
You know. So for me, like, self-awareness is really critical for myself. But why do you think it happens to some people much later in life than others? Are we just talking about societal conditioning here?
Not sure I have a strong enough grasp on this exact moment to sort of. I guess you mean like.
Why are some people more self-aware than others, I guess?
I think societal conditioning has a big part of it. If you're living with parents who are just sort of making, you know, they're just sitting down watching TV from morning till night.
That was it.
And not really thinking about bigger things. They're not having many discussions. They're not reading much. They're not curious, then you're going to also be brought up in that sort of mindset, and it's going to be harder for you to break out of that. So I think that's a part of it. Maybe there's, I don't know, maybe there are some genetic predispositions for some people who are more likely to be curiously minded and think about this stuff than others. Mm-hmm. That's also true. I think with all things, it's probably a combo of nature and nurture. Mm-hmm. Why some people? I think it's a combination of both, but probably situation. You know, like I would say I was, in some ways, I've always been a very curious person. I was always interested in science and so on, but I still had the idea of sitting down and like having a philosophical discussion with someone wasn't really high on my agenda until I started being surrounded by people who were really interested in that. Mm. And then I sort of sat in and listened to some really high level philosophical discussions. I was like, wow, this is a whole new world. And so then I've sort of made a concerted effort to be around more of those people. And then it just sort of was like a snowball, you know, in a positive direction, from my opinion. I think it's a combination of things in terms of probably just enough life experience as well. Like usually, a lot of people will go through sort of, I guess, a sort of awakening after they've been through some very bad experiences. If you've had a very like cushy life where you haven't needed to be pressed or stressed in some way, where you've had to have then really deep sort of self-reflection, that's going to delay it as well. I think it's probably a combination of upbringing, random life experiences, and maybe just personality dispositions.
Sounds like the antidote is to just teach poker in school and create a lot of little poker players.
I don't know, whether necessarily purely poker, but just to teach sort of intro level rationality and statistics and philosophy. Yeah, like it's a shame we didn't get taught any philosophy in school.
No, nothing.
None. Like not even just the basics. Mm. Well, you know, and I mean, because what's mindfulness? Mindfulness is basically sort of introductory. It's like 101 of philosophy. We weren't even taught that. They're starting to teach it now in some schools, which is great.
And they're incorporating meditation in some schools.
Yeah, exactly. This kind of thing, whatever you want to call it, spiritual awareness. Mm. To be fair, like in my school we had prayer. You know, it was a semi-religious school, and I think, you know, I'm not a fan of organized religion, but at the same time, there's definitely value in prayer, like to an extent of some kind, because it's a moment of like meditation.
Yeah, it is the same with meditation, except the words are probably different.
The words are different, and sometimes it's a little bit sort of fatalistic and removing the responsibility from yourself, because you're like just saying, oh. This person's in charge, actually. I answer to this person only. It's like, well, no, you should probably answer to yourself as well and take some responsibility for your things. But, I think I think probably some of the intentions behind many religions were very good. They've just gotten twisted. In terms of like this sort of self-awareness, self-actualization. And I mean, also, I don't think it's as clear-cut as like you either are or you aren't. I think you can fluctuate. I'll go through some months where I'm feel like I'm channeling the universe, and other months where I feel just useless and low confidence and not achieving anything I want to do and depressed or whatever, and it's just it's a thing that sort of can come and go, and I think it requires continual work. It's not like you suddenly have it and now it's stuck with you for the rest of your life.
The other thing that you said around that, and I picked it up when I was reading, was if we do have this self-awareness and we can cultivate it ourselves, but one of the ways or the best ways that worked for me was surrounding myself with people who were self-aware, and therefore because I'm around them, I'm going to become more self-aware, right. I'm more like that. So that got me thinking that would be one way of, you know, changing your beliefs, as you know, when I was listening to your, reading your article. Poker, in terms of networking, the person who decides to do it alone versus the person who gets a peer group to go do it. Mm-hmm. And in my work in alcohol, you know, when people stop drinking alcohol, they get in a really, really super lonely place where suddenly they're on their own
because their social group is probably around alcohol.
It's all around alcohol, and they're not. And I have to keep trying to say to them, I understand how you feel right now, but there are 7.5 billion people in the world, and there are people exactly like you, right? Now, I've seen your life from the outside because you're a celebrity within poker, you know, and outside of poker now. So you're able to see you kind of evolve, if you like. So where do you stand on utilizing this as a tool to advance in life? Like, are we saying that it makes sense for us to say, hang on a minute, who are my friends and should I hang around with them, and who actually do I want to hang around with? Is it an energy thing? If I put off this really great energy, I'm going to attract really great energy people. So, for example, nobody in my life drinks alcohol right now, and before everybody did. Mm-hmm. How does that work out? Like, have I gone and done that? Or is my brain doing that? Is the universe doing that? Where's your old thinking around advancing friendships and stuff?
Distill that down into a clearer question. Like,
Do you think what's your thoughts on almost manufacturing it? So like me saying,
right. Manufacturing your surroundings.
I'm lonely right now, right? I work hard to mask my loneliness, but I'm aware enough to know that I need to go out and take action. So I need to create a meetup group and tell people in that meeting group the types of people I want to attend. So I'm almost like manufacturing it rather than just hanging around in Starbucks,
right,
and bumping into
someone. Seeing, yeah.
And I feel...
Oh, I think manufacturing is a very positive thing. A lot of people go like, oh, well, a lot of people sort of reject the idea of like, oh, wait, you're going out and actively choosing your friends.
Yeah.
Like, no, like, I mean, you have one life, as far as we know. So you're the only limited resource that you truly have is your time. So that's the thing that you need to manage the best. And so if you're just sort of going to, you know, let the laws of randomness, laws of universe, whatever you want to call it, like, determine who it is that you allow in your circle and so forth, that's not optimal. No, I mean, since I sort of more actively started, I wouldn't say it was, like, super active. Like, some of it was just, like, I've always been naturally more attracted to people who I find are very deep, big thinkers,
mm-hmm.
Who are very ambitious. Not always, you know, ambitious in some way. And so I've naturally gravitated towards those people. I wouldn't say it was necessarily an active choice. I'm only going to be friends with these kind of people.
No.
It's just I found them more interesting, and so I've ended up sort of being around them more. There have been a few instances where I remember I was sort of friends with someone in my sort of earlier 20s who, looking back on it, was just purely negative. They were very unkind to me quite often, and I think there was probably just some, I don't know what was going on, some jealousy or whatever. There was just a negative relationship, but I didn't have the experience or the emotional maturity or the self-confidence to recognize that this is not what you need, or, you know, what I should be spending time in as a friend.
Right.
They had their fun moments and they were a funny person, but they were definitely not a positive, they weren't uplifting.
Mm.
And they weren't encouraging growth in any way, and so there are definitely going to be like negative people in your life that you need to make an active sort of decision to go, actually, you know what, this is not optimal, and I'm going to move away from this. But in terms of like choosing new friends, yeah, it's not a bad thing. If you think, actually, you know what, I'm dissatisfied with what I currently have as my social situation, and I want to look for these kind of people, then that's a good thing. But at the same time, it doesn't have, if you're not like actively seeking it and you're just sort of like going with who you find interesting, as long as you're sort of reflecting on yourself about why you find them interesting, I guess that's fine too. So yeah, I'd say we're just with my, I'm very happy with my friendship situation, extremely happy. And there's a few people in there who I've actively sought out. I was like, person who
I
who's
be
writing
I this person.
Yeah, there was like, for example, there was someone who's just like writing I really liked, and I was like, you know what, I know that this person and I are going to get on very well,
yeah,
and I'm going to seek them out, and found, you know, and a good friendship came out of it. And then there's others who I've just bumped into who I just happened to resonate with, and it just goes like that. And I mean, I think though that I do find difficult about life in general, particularly sort of like the traveling life where you just meet a lot of people, is that I'm just always like, oh, this person, I haven't seen them in so long, and they're so great. And this like constant sort of FOMO of not spending as much time with all these wonderful people that sort of you meet along the like your life path.
Because you can only,
spend so much time with people. And so there's,
especially deep connections, right?
Yeah. But what I love are these ones that, you know, you haven't, like I saw an old friend who I knew from university. I saw her for the first time a few months ago. I hadn't seen her in 3 years, but the moment we saw each other, we were just immediately back into it, you know? There was no like small talk or anything.
Yeah.
We were just instant, and like those But there's none of that, like, she was, you know, there was, because I'm usually the one who's, like, bad at getting in touch with people. There was none of that, like, guilt. She didn't make me feel guilty about that at all. She was just like, no, you've been doing your thing, and she's been doing her thing, and it was just instantly wonderful. So, but yeah, that is a tough part of life, which I don't think I'll ever get over, and maybe shouldn't, where you're just like, ah, just not being able to spend enough time with everybody that you want to spend time with.
What about the opposite? It's a little bit expanding on what you talked about. What's the advice that you would give to somebody who feels that they're really lonely and they're just stuck in a state of inertia? Because I know poker players listening to this, when I was doing a lot of high stakes interviews recently on the Triton series, the one theme that came up was loneliness. A lot. So what advice would you give to people?
That's a tough one. I mean, I think a lot of people, from what I understand, people who often struggle to go out and make new friends, like they came here to the Bahamas, right, for the first time, and they're not, you know, they're perhaps feeling low confidence because, well, it's their first time coming to a big tournament like this, so it's natural for you to always have imposter syndrome. Like, that's the first thing, is remember that you're not alone with imposter syndrome. That's so common. So, like, finding that initial confidence to go out and just, like, strike up a conversation with someone is, I found that that's easier to get over if you're both doing a common thing. Like, going to a bar is the worst. I remember going out by myself once in Australia. I was like, I'm going to go out by myself and see if I can make some friends. And I couldn't do it. No. I was in a bar, I was standing there, and there were, like, groups of people having their conversation groups, and I was just standing by the bar, and I was like, wow, these people probably think I'm a prostitute, and I'm just this weird girl standing here making eye contact with people, and no one's really talking to me, and I didn't know how to go talk to people. And I ended up leaving, and I was like, well, that was an interesting experiment.
Yeah.
But if you're doing an activity or something which you're all there to do, well, now you have a reason to be, like, talking to someone.
Yeah.
Bars are the worst, because there's no, like, you're like there, what you're there to meet people, but you're not meeting people doing something. You're just, like, all casually milling around, and that's the worst. So going to, like, an example that sticks out in my mind is that I've recently gotten into climbing very much.
Yeah, I noticed.
And I like going there because it's so easy to strike up a conversation with someone, because they'll be, like, trying to do a problem, you know, on the wall, and you'll be watching, and you can, maybe you'll get an inkling of what they're doing wrong, or nothing else, just, like, watching them do something that you couldn't do, and you're learning something. And you instantly have, like, a topic that it's okay to talk to them about. Mm. It's like people who talk about, like, when they have their dog. Like, oh, I have a dog, and I take it for a walk, I'm so popular. Because you have a common thing to talk about someone with, and it's, like, not this, like, you're just going up to a stranger and be like, hi, I want to talk to you. It's like, oh, your dog is really interesting, blah, blah, blah. And now, like, a natural conversation will spin off from the side of it.
We're doing it now on your Vox article.
Right, exactly.
So it's your Garcia earlier on.
Exactly. It's about having a sort of a common interesting thing that you can start a conversation up with, and then things will just, like, you know, flow from there. And I mean, and that takes practice as well. And so, yeah, my advice to you is if you're someone who is sort of struggling with loneliness or perhaps, like, social anxiety in terms of going out and just, like, striking up conversations with people you don't know, is go and find an activity, particularly one that also attracts that also, like, perhaps more introverted type of people. Mm. Maybe it's a martial art, or it's a drawing class, or something like that. But something that you are sort of, you don't have to be super interested in it, but something you, like, have a passing interest in. That you think, well, you know, that would be a way to try. But I think the kind of people that are also going to be interested in this may be people that I might have something in common with, or at least are similar, like perhaps also introverted people, something like that. And well, now you've got a common thing to talk about. And, yeah. And that's how you'll, like, build friendships, from, like, working on a common goal together of some kind.
I think that's a great place to leave it. Thanks a lot for chatting with me, Liv, as always.
I talked on a bit much.
Ruth said she loved where she was just after 30 days of working on The Truth About Alcohol Taster. Sue said The Truth About Alcohol Taster was, hand on heart, the best decision she ever made. I have learned that alcohol is no place in my life and I am no longer alone, said Rhonda. Jennifer said the intensive helped her beyond just quitting drinking. She now leads a fuller, more awakened life. Nikki said the intensive brought a depth of awareness that has changed the way she now views the world. Talking about the intensive, Maureen said, you will not regret taking this experience, but you will regret passing it up. Shit gets real. You are in it. And that, for me, is reason enough to dive in. The self-growth and discovery it offers is profound, as are the connections you make. Talking about Strive,
Bonnie said, the people in Strive felt like new friends with lots of wonderful support for each other. Tony said, Strive is inclusive and supportive. There is so much empathy, understanding, and encouragement. And this is where I am not a number on a balance sheet. This is where I found home. Julian said, I believe we are defined by the people and ideas we surround ourselves with. And so the warmth, support, and personal growth I've found at Strive make it the place I want to be, the place I have to be. You drank alone. Do not quit alone. Head to thetruthaboutalcohol.co.uk and invest in yourself today. Become someone that doesn't drink alcohol.